This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
We're here this morning to talk about what you should know about retirement planning, maybe even to take a retirement planning course. And, of course, it's never too easy to do this. And to lead us is James Marshall, federal retirement counselor, specialist, instructor, consultant, and knower of all things federal. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Bob. You name it. That's my title.
Okay. Well, it's great to have you. And we're going to cover an awful lot of things this morning. And if anyone would like to call as we are going along, please do. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And my name is Bob Lines, and I'm in a tax finance type. Okay, so I suppose there aren't too many questions that somebody couldn't call that we couldn't answer. And I guess unless it's health or legal.
Yeah, we cover most of the bases over here.
All righty. So one of the top points that you had on your I want to talk about list was pension vesting. Well, what's vesting anyway?
Well, pension vesting is, there is a cost associated with being in the retirement system, whether you're under the civil service retirement system, which is the old retirement system. By all means, it doesn't mean that you're old if you're in that system. It just means that you're in a system, a retirement pension plan that's been around since 1920. But also, if you're under the new retirement system, FERS, the Federal Employees Retirement System, which came out in the late 80s, there's a cost associated with being under that pension plan as a federal employee. If you've got an appointment that deems that you're going to be a covered employee, covered either under CSRS or FERS, you have a certain amount of money withheld automatically from your paycheck every single pay period. And that is going into a bucket of money called the Civil Service Retirement and Disability Fund.
So this is not the thrift?
It's not. It has nothing to do with the thrift at all. The TSP, Thrift Savings Plan, is similar to those 401k plans that you guys have talked about on some of the other shows, and we may touch a little bit at the end of the day about, but it has nothing to do with your thrift savings plan. That source of income or retirement savings vehicle is different. It's separate from this thing called the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund. This bucket of money is what the Office of Personnel Management uses, OPM, to pay your pensions, either under CSRS or under FERS, for the rest of your life whenever you retire from the federal government. So it's a completely different bucket of money, unrelated to Social Security or the Thrift Savings Plan.
When we talk about it in Claire's, of course, coming from the tax side, when the annuity kicks in when they retire, a part of that annuity is non-taxable because of exactly what you just said. This money was involuntarily withheld.
That's right. A very small piece of it is non-taxable because compared to the amount of money that they put in over their lifetime, which is the point that I like to make in my class, part of the class, is that, it's nothing compared to what you're going to get for the rest of your life. If you live for another, for a good 4 or 5 years in retirement, you will have already received all that money back, because that money that's in that bucket that OPM uses to pay your pensions, it's reduced dollar for dollar as you receive your pension. But for as long as you live, that's the whole point of a pension. It's an annuity payable for the rest of your life. As long as the federal government doesn't go under, you've got a payment. But there's no way that Uncle Sam's going to let you keep that pension for the rest of your life tax-free, so... I'm sure you guys have other radio shows where y'all explain the taxation of your pensions and all that. But you guys do cover it in the classes.
Oh, we nail it in class.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad you brought it up first, because there are a fair number of people in class that go, "What withholding? No, that's my thrift. No, that's my Medicare. Or if they're FERS, that's my Social Security." And I go, "No, it's none of the above.
That's right.
This has nothing to do with it, and really doesn't have anything to do with the annuity that they're entitled to when they retire.
That's right.
It's just money that was withheld.
That's right, because there's a lot of money in that bucket that they never see. The agency is putting some contributions. CSRS employees pay 7%. Of their pay every pay period with post-tax dollars. FERS employees and CSRS offset employees, they both pay 0.8% of their pay every pay period, with post-tax dollars going into that bucket. But what they don't see is the agency putting in some money as well. And again, OPM uses all that money to pay those pensions. But that money is going to be reduced dollar for dollar as you start receiving your pension. It's also it's reduced dollar for dollar as any survivor benefits that might be paid out. Now, OPM uses that bucket of money to pay not only pensions, but they also use that bucket to pay survivor benefits. So the whole point, you know, and the main focus of this today's radio show is talking about, you know, why should I take a retirement class? Because everything that we're talking about today is covered in our full day classes. And we're not the only folks out there teaching these classes. There's other folks out there, but we won't mention them at this point. But it's I don't care where you get the class from. It's so important, whether you're a brand new employee or in the middle of your career or at the end of your career, to take one of these classes, and maybe more than once, because the laws and regulations could change. And that's how you sometimes can keep up to date, is other than listening to this radio show every week, is if it's something changes, you know, you take a class and you can learn about those changes. But, you know, going back onto this subject about vesting in the pension plan versus, versus your money that's actually in the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund, you know, I think we can already see, you know, that pension is more valuable than that money that you put in.
Oh, yeah.
To that bucket. You know, just an example, someone who's 25 years old, been working for the federal government, you know, on average been making about $50,000 a year. You know, after 5 years of contributions, we're only talking about 0.8%. You know, so you're not going to go out and buy a house with this money. You're not going to buy a car. You know, after about 5 years of service, making about $50,000 a year, you might have about $2,000 in that bucket. You know, $2,000. What are you going to, you know, when you leave federal service, they're going to give you a separation packet. They're going to allow you to take that money out. You know, they're not going to try to force
you. If you leave early.
If you leave early. Yeah. If you leave federal service, or even if you leave. You know, if you leave federal service for any reason, one of your options is to take that money out. But I would never want to take that money out because it's a guaranteed investment. Unlike your 401k plans, your TSPs, your IRAs, now, this is a guaranteed payment for the rest of your life if you're vested. And it takes 5 years, either under CSRS or under FERS, to be vested for the pension. But even if you're 23 years old with 3 years of contributions and you're not vested yet, but you still have that money in there, if you were to take that $1,000 out after 3 years of service, you're giving up your pension payable later on in life. And even if, you know, you're only 23 years old, you might come back to federal service later on in life. And if you left that money alone, you pick up right where you left off whenever you come back to federal service later. So that's the nice thing about the FERS retirement system. It's very portable. You know, your thrift savings plan, you know, that can be a portable. It can be left alone when you leave federal service. You can roll it into a 401k plan. If you go out in the private sector, you're not retired. If you ever come back to the federal government, you can obviously roll that money right back into a TSP account. So, but your pension plan, you know, it's intended to, you know, pick up right where you left off as long as you left that money alone. Now, if you had someone, for example, who only worked for 3 years, you know, that's still accruing interest. You know, it's on the Treasury fund. It's not necessarily keeping up with inflation, but certainly it's not. You're not losing the money. And if you never come back and finish, you know, 2 more years to be vested, to be eligible for a pension payable in your lifetime, then by all means, later on in life, you can always ask for that money out, and they'll pay you plus interest.
Can you, if you left federal service and took this money out, despite your good counsel, and you came back to federal service, FERS, can FERS people now redeposit the money that they took out?
They can now if they return to federal service. There was a time prior to, in the old days, prior to October 2009, if you want to call that the old days, they just changed the law last year that allows FERS employees, if they took the money out of the FERS retirement system in the past, if they return to federal service, and that's the key point, they got to return to federal service. If they return to federal service, then OPM now allows them to put that money back into the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund to get that service credit back. But again, whether you're 23 or 25 with 5 years of service, or if you're 40 with 20 years of service, I always recommend that they leave the money alone because there's no guarantees that you'll ever get a federal job again later on in life. You know, there's no promises. So it's not a bad idea. It's not a lot of money. I mean, by all means, it doesn't hurt to just leave it right where it is if you leave federal service.
And if they did take it out and they came back, I think they have to pay interest on the redeposit.
Absolutely. Uncle Sam wants the money that he gave you plus the interest that he would have made on it had you not taken it out in the first place.
Yeah,
so he'll charge you interest as well. So, you know, some people say, well, you know, maybe I can invest it somewhere when I leave federal service at the age of 30, for example. I got 10 years of service under FERS, and I plan on coming back to the federal government. But remember, there's no promises. But yeah, if you go out there and you invest that money, you make a better deal with it. You know, if you never come back to federal service, you can never put that money back in. So there's no guarantees that you'll get a federal job later on in life.
Yeah. Okay. So and for those listening, again, we're not talking about Social Security, Medicare, or the thrift. This is involuntary withholding James mentioned.
Yeah.
So, and investing, you know, people say, well, you vest for this or you vest for that. What's vesting?
Well, vesting means that you become entitled or eligible for the benefit. It may not be that you're eligible for it immediately. Like, for example, Social Security, it takes about 10 years of paying Social Security taxes. Now, you're 30 years old. You've been working for 10 years. You're vested for a Social Security benefit, but you're not old enough yet. In some situations, you got to meet a certain age before you're eligible for the actual benefit. But vesting means that at some point later on in life or immediately, depending on your age, for example, you're going to be eligible for that benefit. So that's what we're talking about, vesting. You're allowed to have that benefit.
So vesting kind of means qualifies.
Qualify, that's correct. Okay, that's a good word.
Okay, well, those nickel words I have a hard time with. Penny words, I'm okay.
But as far as vesting and CSRs or FERS, people don't have to memorize this stuff. But just from my experience looking at people's records, on average, for every 5 years of contributions, whether you're FERS or CSRS, because the pensions are computed differently, but they're all relative. CSRS pension, CSRS folks pay more into the retirement system than FERS folks, but they also get more out of it later on in life than FERS folks. But on average, every 5 years you work as a federal employee, you're going to get the money that you put into the pension plan within 1 year of collecting your pension, whether that's upon separation or whether that's because you have to wait 20 years later until you meet the age requirement to be eligible for that pension. As we have other class, that's what we spend time in the classes, is helping people understand when I'm eligible to receive the benefit once I'm vested. And so we talk about all that stuff. But on average, every 5 years of contributions that you put into the retirement system, it takes about 1 year. And that's all it takes. 1 year, you get that money back for the rest of your life. Every year, you keep getting that money, though. Yeah. And so that's the nice thing. Plus some cost of living adjustments that we also teach in those classes as well. When do you start getting your COLAs? And how do those COLAs affect your pensions?
Of course, we talk about the differential between the tax treatment of it and the economic treatment. The tax treatment, whatever they put in throughout their career, is then spread out over an IRS-sanctioned life expectancy table so that the annuity that they do get when they retire isn't fully taxed, but it's close to fully taxed because some of it's considered to be a return, but James mentioned the money that went into the pot over the year. Whereas if somebody were to pass early, 5 or 10 years into retirement, there's no money at OPM.
That's right.
I don't want to start a firestorm with that, but they are treated differently, one for tax, one for economics. But it makes sense. And if you look at somebody that way outlived their life expectancy, they don't stop paying the annuity.
That's right.
So it kind of cuts both ways. But that's a hard sell sometimes in front of a group of 30 to 50 people. All righty, so I think we got pension vesting, and we got this idea that we do have monies taken out of our salary other than what we know is coming out. Sometimes you don't even feel this, especially if you're FERS, because it's not necessarily a huge number.
Yeah.
And also, people, you can look at your last leave and earnings statement. You can see a collective amount withheld. But I caution people, this is not from your first date of employment, unless you're very new on the job. So if you're 20, 25 years into your job, that number is just what was withheld since the last change pay centers.
So that's right.
Agencies switched to pay centers.
That's right.
And whatever was withheld prior to the switch gets shipped off to OPM.
That
number on that last leave and earnings statement is kind of like an odometer that gets set back to zero.
That's right. When I teach my part of the classes, I explain to folks, because a lot of folks, either for tax purposes or maybe because for other things like related to like voluntary contributions, they want to know how much money they're allowed to put into that VC program that you guys taught recently in one of your most recent radio shows. But, I explain to folks that every time, if you ever want to know how much money you have in the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund, every time you change agencies, whether that you're leaving federal service or if you transfer to another agency or anytime you're working for the same agency and you have a payroll office conversion, you're contributions into the retirement system get printed on these individual retirement records, or they call it IRRs. There's one for FERS and there's one for CSRS. These records, the payroll office send them off to OPM for record keeping. They get kept up in that mountain up in Boyers, Pennsylvania, where they hide all the UFOs and everything else up there. And those records are maintained. So that way, if that information ever needs to be obtained, especially at retirement, to find out all service that you've contributed into the retirement system for, also to figure out the tax for tax purposes, those 1099-R forms that you get each January after you've been retired from OPM, they need to know those amounts. If you ever want to know those amounts, you can request those. Sometimes the best way is to go through your agency HR first, your benefits office, or you can go to OPM directly and request those records. And they're, the name of those forms for FERS employees are standard form 3100s. They look it up by your name, your date of birth, and your Social Security number, or any names you've ever gone by. Because you got to keep in mind, Boyers, Pennsylvania, you know, OPM, the Civil Service Retirement System has been around before Social Security, so they don't file those things by Social Security number. They file them by names. And even though Social Security came out 15 years after CSRS came out, those records are not maintained by Social Security number. But you still need that number, of course, to find those records. But for CSRS, those records are on SF-2806s. Those are called individual retirement records. If anybody ever wants to find out how much money they put in, if they've been working for the federal government for any length of time where they've transferred agencies, had breaks in service, or had payroll office conversions, number one, they look at their pay stubs, like you said, Bob, but they also need to get those other amounts from those other records at OPM.
Especially if somebody bought, say, military time, because that wouldn't necessarily have been withheld. Well, clearly it wouldn't have been withheld from the military salary, but they'll write a check to OPM along with some interest.
That's right.
And so that number is in there, too. And again, it's important for tax reasons.
That's right.
Because they get a tax deduction for that.
Sure. And the military deposits now, those are actually paid with your agencies. And the civilian deposits, civilian redeposits are paid directly to OPM. So what happens is when an employee pays a military deposit to their agency, just like they have the money withheld, when they pay that, whether it's a check or whether they have it withheld from their pay, when they pay these military deposits, that SF-3100 or that 2806 individual retirement record gets printed off by the payroll office, sent to OPM for record keeping. So sometimes that amount is not always included into their pay stub. So yeah. It's always good. I mean, it's not really needed unless you're one of these type of people that really want to know what the non-taxable portion of your annuity is. You really don't need to be concerned about how much money you have in there, because your pension is going to be computed. You know, has nothing to do with how much money you have in that that bucket. You know, the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund, your pension is computed based on a formula which is defined by law. So we're not really here to talk
about
that.
And OPM makes that calculation, and to the class I get, you know, does OPM mess up? And I go, no, they do an outstanding job given the volume that they have to do, and they have these records. And if you want to check on it, if you're that compulsive, you can. Like you say, go to your HR office first, and some of those have a wire into OPM, as I understand it, not all, but all will, I guess, in not the near term, but a couple years. Anyway, I think we've got this squared away. Sick leave versus annual leave, shortly before leaving federal service. What should one be aware of?
Well, whether you're FERS or CSRS, because of the recent change last October, you know, they made some adjustments to the pension plans, both under CSRS and FERS under the laws. And one of the laws that helps FERS employees, it's always been in effect for CSRS employees, is that now FERS employees, just like CSRS employees, are going to be allowed to use sick leave in the computation of their pensions. And so whether you're a FERS employee or a CSRS employee, I would say about 2 years before you retire, you want to project out your sick leave balance. You want to project it out to figure out how will that impact, you know, my pension. How much money will I get for the rest of my life for the amount, number of hours of unused sick leave that I have on the books at the time of separation? And the reason why I say you should do this about 2 years in advance, because you're going to want to plan this out so that way you have time to use a certain number of sick leave hours, for example, without affecting the computation of your pension. And so, for example, if I was getting ready to retire in 2 years, I would look at my current sick leave balance on my pay stub, you know, write those numbers, those number of hours down. And then I would look at the payroll calendar and I would count the number of pay periods that I plan on working between now and the date of my retirement. And for each full pay period that I plan to work, I'm going to give myself credit for 4 hours of sick leave, because all federal employees earn 4 hours of sick leave per pay period. So you multiply those number of pay periods times four, add that to your current sick leave balance. And if you use no sick leave between now and the date of your separation for retirement, that's how many hours you would have on the books. The law now says for FERS employees as well as CSRS employees, they're going to take those hours and they're going to convert them into years, months, and days. And they're going to add those sick leave hours, those years, months, and days, to your years, months, and days of service that you actually performed that's credible for retirement purposes as a federal employee, as well as any military service if you paid your military deposits, for example. And so when you add the years, months, and days of sick leave to your years, months, and days of service, when you add them together, whatever days are left over, they always drop the days, because when OPM, you know, computes your pensions, they only use years and months. So whatever days are left over, you can actually take those days and convert them back to hours. And that's how many hours of sick leave you can use between now and the date of your retirement. And so if you had, you know, 28 days worth of sick leave to burn off, if you waited to the last minute, you may not have enough time to use 28 or 29 days of sick leave between now and the date of your retirement. That's why I always recommend people do this maybe 2 years before they retire. But the one of the examples I give in the class, and I see it a lot whenever I sit down and work with folks, is, you know, during breaks or at the end of the day, I usually stick around as long as anybody needs me to go over their unique scenarios or their service details and helping them maybe choose a good date to retire, for example. But I sit down and I look at their number of years, months, and days total after you add into their sick leave, and sometimes they only have a couple of days left. And those couple of days are going to be lost if they don't use them. And so in some situations, someone's thinking, well, I'm going to retire in a couple of years from now. I need to take more than 2 days of sick leave because I plan on seeing the doctor a few times this year, maybe a few times next year. And I'll just use an example of 40 out. What if I needed to use 5 days of sick leave over the next couple of years? Well, when you start, you know, and the theme of my classes is I say, look, these are all benefits that are defined by law. If you do this, this is what will happen. And if you do this, over here, this is what will happen. And you decide what's best for you. You know, what's right for one person may not be right for someone else. But if you are, as long as you're clear with what your options are, you're going to be the best person to decide for yourself. So in this example, let's talk about someone who has maybe just a couple of days left over, but they need to use 5 days. You know, maybe 5 or 7 days of sick leave between now and the time that they separate. Well, annual leave, you know, is going to be paid out. You could use annual leave if you wanted to, and that way you don't, you know, take those months and lose a month's worth of annuity for the rest of your life. But for a FERS employee who's getting ready to retire, you know, let's say that they're making on average, you know, maybe around $100,000, you know, I'm sorry, yeah, maybe about $50,000, $60,000, or even $100,000. Let's make it a big $100,000 high three average salary, which is used in the computation of their pension.
We could divide that by half if we weren't that high.
That's right.
Okay.
But just even if it was that high, you know, you're only losing $7 a month. You know, a month's worth of service has got a value of about $7 a month. So if you're only making about $50,000 a year on average when you leave, a month's worth of annuity is about $3 or $4. And what does that mean? That means, you know, if I'm going to work for a couple more months, I'm going to get an extra $6 a month for the rest of my life. Or if I'm going to, you know, if I'm making $100,000 a year on average when I leave federal service as a FERS employee, I'm going to get an extra $7. You know, if I work for 2 more months, I'm going to increase my annuity permanently by $14 a month for the rest of my life.
With a COLA, maybe.
Yeah, and you get some COLAs later on as well. So, you know, but for CSRS, you can double the amount. It's about $13 a month for someone who's making about $100,000 a year. You know, divide it in half if you're making about $50,000. So, you know, a lot of people think, oh, no, I don't want to use those 5 days of sick leave because I'm going to lose a month's worth of annuity. But they don't realize that we're only talking maybe about $7 a month or $13 a month if you're CSRS. You know, what is a week's worth of annual leave worth? You know, your annual leave usually gets paid out within 1 or 2 pay periods after you leave federal service. All the annual leave hours that are on the books at the time of separation get paid out. And one of the things that we teach in our classes, and, you know, a good reason to take these classes, is that, you know, how to maximize that annual leave payment. You know, 40 hours of annual leave for someone making $100,000 a year, that's a couple $1,000. If you're making $50,000 a year, that's $1,000. You know, how long would it take you to get $1,000 or to get $2,000 at the rate of $7 a month? You know, it would take you many years. For a FERS employee, it would take them 23 years to get that $2,000. For a CSRS employee, it would take them just over 12 years. So the question would be, when do you want your money? There's no wrong answers here, but when do you want your money? Do you want your money within a month after you leave federal service in the form of a lump sum annual leave payment? Or do you want that money, you know, every month for the rest of your life, you know, at the rate of $7 a month?
And the accumulated leave qualifies to be put into a type of IRA, whether that's a traditional or whether it's a Roth. It's considered to be earned income. So if somebody retires at the end of the calendar year, FERS, or the beginning part of the next year, generally speaking, but not always, for CSRSers, that money that they get for the accumulated leave is paid via a W-2. W-2 at face value qualifies for IRA, as well as the last salary.
That's right.
Yeah. So in that next year, if they were not going to work at all, they still would have a basis for be able to fund an IRA, again, whether it's a traditional or it's a Roth. But that's another subject from a prior day.
Sure. but it's all related to choosing your best day to retire. I mean, and we cover that in those classes. You know, the first day we teach them what they can and can't do and what's the effect of their benefits. And the second day you guys get into financial planning and tax planning and help them understand the tax implications of choosing one day versus another, especially when it comes to your lump sum and your leave payment and what you can do with that money.
Yeah.
Yep.
All righty. So, importance of understanding how a pension is computed. Now, here I'm going to be all ears.
Okay.
I've been doing this for an awful long time, but when you all talk about this, I go, huh? So, which is the easier one to talk about?
Well, I don't think I need to go into the details as far as, you know, that's what the classes are for, and that's what the, you know, I mean, you know, it's understanding the formulas that are defined by law that's used to compute your pensions, but that's why I think it's important to take a class or to go get some counseling with your retirement officer or from your benefits office at your agency. You want to understand how is my pension, how does my pension work? How is it computed? Number one, so you can plan your retirement. You know, you need a certain amount of money whenever you get ready to retire. You know, you're not going to be collecting a paycheck anymore. How much money are you going to receive in your pension? You know, and that's the nice thing about your pension plan, whether you're FERS or CSRS, unlike your health, I mean, unlike your thrift savings plans, unlike your 401ks, your IRAs, you know, who knows what those things are going to look like 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road. They have the shape of an amoeba. And, you know, and once you start drawing that money out as a source of income in retirement, you know, who knows how long that money's going to last. But your pensions are payable for the rest of your life, and those pensions are computed based on these formulas that are defined by law. And so we don't need to go into the formulas to explain the importance of understanding how your pensions are computed, because we're all responsible for understanding our benefits. And you made a comment earlier about, you know, OPM never makes mistakes. And I think that maybe that was a little tongue in cheek, because, you know, OPM is made of people. Agencies are made of people. HR offices, I see mistakes quite a bit. Not necessarily always at OPM. Sometimes it's the records that are sent to OPM from the agency level that are sometimes erroneous. And sometimes OPM, they don't notice those mistakes, or it's impossible for them to interpret them as mistakes. So we just got to be careful. If we know how our benefits are computed, if OPM is going to pay me less than what I'm expecting because I know how my pension is computed, then I'm going to pick up the horn and call somebody. Now, if OPM wants to overpay me, I'm not going to call anybody. Just kidding. You didn't hear me say that. I mean, if there's something wrong with the way the pension that OPM adjudicates, you know, the Office of Personnel Management, you want to get on the horn and straighten that out, because if they overpaid you, I have an example of that coming up in a moment, you know, they're going to want that money back, and they're going to take it back usually at the rate that they paid you, overpaid you. So, you know, you don't want to have any problems later on in life, but you don't want any surprises. Nobody likes surprises, especially whenever you're going from working to retiring. You're trying to make that transition. You don't want any surprises. And to avoid those surprises, you know, if you understand how your pension is computed, number one, you're going to know how much money you're going to get for the rest of your life. You know, I can teach people in our classes, whether you're retiring next year or 20 years down the road, as long as you understand this formula that's used to compute your benefits under FERS or CSRS, you'll have a good idea what that monthly check is going to look like, you know, before taxes, for example. And so there's no surprises. And also you can answer that question, can I afford to retire financially? You know, because you're going to know what that monthly payment is. That's the number one reason. But also, you know, folks make mistakes. I'll give you one example. I was retiring a gentleman up there on the Hill. And those folks up there on the Hill, you know, their high three average salaries don't always come from the last 3 years. You know, the law, and one of the part of the formula defined by the law for CSRS and FERS is that they use a high three average salary. The three consecutive years, wherever you made the most money, basic pay-wise, working as a federal civilian employee, they're going to take those three consecutive years, add it all up, that basic pay, divided by three, that's going to be your high three average salary. That high three average salary is part of this formula that they use. But it doesn't always have to be the last 3 years, and the law even says it doesn't have to be the last 3 years. But in most cases, you know, we tend to start making a certain amount of money at the beginning of our careers, and we steadily increase our pay all the way up through the date of retirement. And so in most cases, 9 times out of 10, it tends to be the last 3 years. But I remember this one gentleman on the Hill, you know, those folks, they don't have GS schedules like you do in the executive branch. They get paid whatever the member of Congress wants to pay them, and that amount can change on a monthly basis. And so his pay was all over the place. If you can imagine from A to Z, it was up and down throughout his entire career. And his high three average salary, you know, I couldn't eyeball it. I had to use the software. I plugged in all his salary history from A to Z. And his high three average salary came from 10 years before he retired. And the reason why he stuck around, after, you know, he worked for 30 years. But even though he secured his high three at the 20-year mark, he stuck around for another 10 years because he wasn't old enough to collect his pension yet. He had been vested, but he needed to keep working until he was old enough. So at that point, you know, I said, this is what your high three should be. This is what your pension should be. I said, but call me. If I'm off by plus or minus $5 a month, and we can all live off of plus or minus $5 a month, I think, for planning purposes. I told the gentleman, I said, call me, because I have a feeling, you know, I've got enough experience where I see where agencies make mistakes. I see where OPM sometimes makes mistakes. And I said, call me if your annuity, if the annuity that OPM adjudicates is off by more than plus or minus $5. I get a call a couple of months later. And guess who it is? It's this gentleman. He said, hey, James, you know, I want to thank you. Everything got processed, but for whatever reason, OPM's saying that I'm going to get $200 less a month for the rest of my life compared to the estimate that you provided to me before I left. I said, that's okay. Let me take a look at the paperwork. And sure enough, I looked at the high three that they computed, and they used his last 3 years. I said, it's not a problem, sir. What we'll do is I'll call the OPM. I'll talk to the adjudicator. We'll get it straightened out, and you'll get your money back, retroactive. And so I get on the horn. I call the adjudicator. You know, I got a lot of their phone numbers up there, and I call and start talking to them directly. I say, hey, just wanted to go over this person's case because they're retired, and I told them this is how much money they should be getting, and for whatever, I think that you guys maybe made a mistake in this one little area, and it's the high three. And I saw that the high three that they computed was using his last 3 years. And that adjudicator said, well, Mr. Marshall, unfortunately, you know, you can't use his salary details from 10 years before he left. You have to use the last 3 years. And you can imagine, I took a step back as I was thinking, well, maybe I dialed the wrong phone number because this is OPM. These are the people that manage the retirement system. So I said, well, we need to get this resolved. So can I talk with your boss? I talked with the supervisor and the supervisor. And now that's whenever I realized why the adjudicator thought it had to be the last 3 years, because the supervisor had taught her that way. And then finally, the third supervisor, I got through the third supervisor. I was getting ready to show them the reference in the law where it doesn't have to be the last 3 years. And they said, well, Mr. Marshall, we know what it should be. We'll get it corrected. We'll take care of it. But what if that guy never called me? His annuity had already been finalized, adjudicated. He would be living with less than with $200 less a month for the rest of his life. I'm only one person. How many people am I not, you know, seeing out there? I'm not saying that that happens every day. They do have a lot of cases to work through. But whenever I talked with the adjudicator after a few more minutes after we got that thing resolved, you know, they were given instructions, hey, we got a lot of cases, we got to knock out all these widgets, you know, a case is a widget, and they just taught them, hey, just use the last three and we'll get these knocked out. If there's any problems, the retirees will let us know. But if the retiree didn't know how his pension should be computed, he never would have known to pick up the horn and call somebody. So that's why I say it's important to understand how your pensions are computed, because if a mistake is made, you know, if a mistake is made, you can get it corrected. It can always be corrected retroactive.
Yeah, years ago, I actually worked for the government for a while, and there was a gentleman, interestingly enough, somewhat like what you just said, had a heart attack, but worked on the Hill, and couldn't handle the stress anymore, but still good person, good worker, sharp cookie, and was in an agency, and worked, and this was a long time ago, and he explained to me, he says, you know, the annuity isn't just calculated necessarily on your last high three. Your last three. It could be if you had a higher high three. And he indicated that prior to this agency, he made a lot more money on the Hill. And I go, that stuck with me until this moment. I hate to tell you how long ago that was, but nonetheless, I'm not so sure a lot of people are aware of that. So thanks for bringing it to their attention. Now, should we go through the, not the nits of the calculation, because we got law enforcement, we got firefighters, we got air traffic controllers and the like, but a FERS person gets credit for every year that they work for Uncle different than a CSRS or as far as your base level calculation, no?
Yeah, we go into a lot more details in the classes, but for the most part, a FERS employee is going to get 1% of their high three average salary for every year of credible service. You know, that credible service could be some civilian service under FERS, or it could be some military service if they paid their deposit. Because remember, under FERS, they don't get credit for eligibility or for retirement compensation purposes unless there's money in the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund, either via deposit or whether it was withheld from their pay. But on average, we're talking about 1%. There's another formula for, like you said, law enforcement officers and firefighters and congressional employees. There's also another formula for those folks who work long enough beyond the age of 62 with 20-plus years of service. They get 1.1% of that high three for all their years and months of service, because remember, the days are always dropped. So that's the formula. I mean, that's the general formula for FERS. You know, it's 1% in the most cases times their high three for each year of credible service. So that's how the general formula works, yeah.
Okay. And you know, people say, well, I get less because I'm in FERS. And I go, yeah, but you got the agency match with the TSP and the like, and you got Social Security. And somebody's going to say, well, they didn't get a COLA last year, and they're going to say that again this year. But they still do get it.
That's right. And they pay seven times less into the retirement system. You know, they only pay 0.8% of their pay, where CSRS folks pay seven times as much every single pay period, all their career. After a 20- or 30-year career, depending on what kind of salary you made as a CSRS employee, you could have paid $120,000 or $150,000 bucks, whereas a FERS employee only paid maybe $20,000 or $25,000 after a 20-year career. So there's a big difference on how much money you pay into the pension plan as well.
Of course, they didn't pay into Social Security either.
That's right. But FERS folks, their Social Security benefits won't be affected by their CSRS pensions, where the opposite can't be said for CSRS folks. So there's some give and take. Some people didn't have a choice, but the folks who did have a choice, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. Some people wish that they would have remained CSRS when they elected FERS, but you know, you made the best decision that you could make with the information you had
at the time. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, and it generally is not catastrophic if they chose the wrong path.
That's right.
It might be less, but then again, it might be more.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Age factors that one might look at as impacting their benefit from a positive or a negative?
Well, I don't, you know, age, there are certain types of retirements, whether you're FERS or CSRS, that if you retire at a certain age, you know, maybe you meet your minimum retirement age, for example, but you just don't have your total service required for a full pension, there may be a permanent reduction to your annuity for early age. Like, for example, under CSRS, if you're not 55 years old, if you get offered an early out, from your agency, like they're going through some sort of reorganization or restructure and they want to reduce their numbers, they may offer an early retirement to their employees. If you're younger than 55 years old as a CSRS employee, you're going to take a permanent reduction of 2% for each year that you're younger than 55 years old. So if you're 50 years old, you had 20 plus years of service under your belt, you get offered the early out from your agency, you take a permanent 10% reduction to your annuity. But you get to collect your pension 5 years sooner than you otherwise would have had to wait till 55. So I wouldn't say that it's always a negative thing, you know, but you know, a 50-year-old, for example, is very young. They got plenty of life left in them. They're probably not really done working, even though they may be done working for the federal government because they're retiring early. But their chances are they're going to, you know, maybe go find a job somewhere else if there's a job available. So it may not even be a good deal for those folks if there's no jobs out there. So it's never really, I don't really look at it as positive or negative. Again, the whole point of the class is to show them this is what will happen if you do this. And this is what will happen if you don't do this. You decide what's best for you. And you got a lot of factors that you got to weigh in. And when we talk about age reductions, not only is it your pension payable that's going to be affected for the rest of your life, but also survivor benefits. You know, do you have a spouse that you think is going to outlive you for many, many more years? You know, if they need some part of your pension, if you are going to predecease them, you know, your decision to collect less money now versus more money later, because there are ways to avoid these age reductions by either continuing to work, or you can postpone your annuity in situations under FERS, for example. You can postpone your annuity. If you're going out under the MRA plus 10 provision, for example, let's say that under FERS, your MRA, your minimum retirement age.
What's MRA?
That's a minimum retirement age.
Okay.
I was reading your mind there when you said the question. You know, your minimum retirement age under FERS is somewhere between 55 and 57. Everybody under FERS should find out what their MRA is if they don't know it already. But if, you know, typically, if you want a full pension under FERS, you got to have reached your MRA at the time of separation. Plus, you have to have 30 plus years of service. But you know, even though the pensions are not as big as they are under CSRS, there's a lot more flexibility under FERS. Under FERS, you can have as little as 10 years of service and reach your MRA and still collect a pension immediately. You have your health insurance, your life insurance, other federal programs, but you also have a pension. But if you collect it immediately, and if you don't have 30 years of service, but you have at least 10, you're going to take that age reduction. The age reduction for FERS is 5% for each year that they are younger than 62 years old. So if, for example, my MRA was 56 and I had 20 years of service, for example, I don't have 30, I only have 20, I could take my pension now, but I would be dealing with a 30% permanent reduction. It doesn't increase later on in life. It's a permanent reduction, but I can collect my pension sooner. So, you know, I always show the people in the class just examples. This is how much money you'll get if you took the annuity now, and here's how much annuity you would get if you postponed it to later. You decide for yourself what's best for you. Just keep in mind, it's a permanent reduction. Not only does it affect your pension payable for the rest of your life, but it also affects survivor benefits that are payable if you predecease a spouse, for example. So they got to take that all into account whenever they're looking at any age factors that might affect their benefits. And there's only two of them under FERS. It's only under the MRI plus 10 provisions, because under FERS, the nice thing, again, another nice thing about FERS employees, if you get offered an early out as a FERS employee, there is no age reduction. You could be in your mid-40s with 25 plus years of service under your belt. Maybe you started your federal career at a young age. If the agency offered you an early out as a FERS employee, you get a full pension under FERS, whereas a CSRS employee would take a reduction. But for FERS, if you go out under the MRA plus 10 provisions, meaning that you met your MRA, but you don't have 30 years of service, but you have at least 10, you're going to be dealing with that age reduction unless you postpone your annuity.
If you have a survivor's annuity option, what is the greatest percentage that you can provide your survivor of your annuity?
Well, under FERS, the biggest percentage of your pension that you could provide in the event of your death is 50%. You know, they are eligible for half of your pension for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. Under CSRS, it's 55% of their full pension. 55%.
And in order to elect that, then the pension paid to the actual retiree is reduced.
That's right. There's a cost associated with it when you elect these benefits at the time of retirement. There is a cost associated with electing a survivor benefit. You know, they're going to reduce your annuity. It's a reduction, not a deduction. So you come into the in play to talk about how reductions are kind of like pre-tax things and deductions are not in retirement. But we teach that in the classes as well. But there is a cost associated with it. But it's interesting to note the things that I teach in the classes is not only for retirement, but death and service. Now, you don't pay for survivor benefits if you die as an employee. You're actually worth more money if you die as an employee than if you die as a retiree. That upsets some of the employees who bring their spouses to these classes, because then their spouses find out that, hey, you're actually worth more money if I get rid of you before you retire than if I let you keep working and then die, you know, after you retire. So, but it's one of those things that, you know, there is no cost associated with survivor benefits. If you got at least 10 years of credible service as a FERS employee, you could be 30 years old with 10 years of service on your belt. If you died and you're married at the time of your death, your widow or widower would automatically be entitled to 50% of your full earned pension. No reduction for age, and they get cost of living adjustments based on the FERS rules immediately, and that's payable potentially for the rest of their life as long as that widow or widower doesn't remarry before 55. Under CSRS, which most of my CSRS and CSRS offset folks have, you got to have 22 years of service under your belt. Most of them in these days, here we are in 2010, and most of those folks do have 22 years of service already under their belt. If they were to die as an employee, they're not paying for the survivor benefit right now. But if they were to die as an employee, it would be as if they elected a full survivor benefit at the time of their death.
Interesting. I'm not making this up. This was just this past weekend. Got an email from somebody, very short federal career, and the annuity was X, and they were saying, well, gee, if I provide a survivor, I might as well just take the higher amount, figuring that I'm going to have a robust life expectancy. And I emailed back and said, yeah, but what if you're wrong? However small it might be, at least the survivor would then get something, and there was an age differential for mm-hmm. the retiree versus the survivor being a fair number of years younger. And I said, I don't think I'd want to take that risk. And second of all, somebody's got to agree to it, namely the would-be
right.
survivor. So
that's right.
Usually where the rubber hits the road.
Yeah, you got to get your spouse's permission. If you try to provide, at the time of retirement, if you try to provide anything less than a full survivor benefit, whether you're a FERS or CSRS employee to your spouse, if you're married at the time of retirement, they have to sign off on it. You can't be holding a gun to their head because it's got to be notarized.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. If you want to provide them anything less, you know, it's just something, a discussion that needs to be made, you know, between you and your spouse.
No, we have fun with that in class if the spouses are in there.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you need to be informative, but you need to make it light as well.
Sure. And when we talk about death in class, that tends to be where I get the most laughs, just because, you know, people are, you know, it's kind of a serious subject, of course, but it's where most of the laughs come from, because people just, sometimes it's them making up the jokes. They're asking questions and they're saying something. Because they can't believe some of the rules that are governed by laws. They're like, you mean to tell me if this happens, this is what this person gets?
Mm-hmm.
And they're surprised, and it usually brings up some laughs, you know, because it's funny in some situations.
All righty, we're getting close to open season, and as you know, we open up the mics to the different insurance companies during open season starting, I guess, early next month.
Right.
But health insurance, as far as planning for retirement, does an individual that's retired have the same options as an employee when open season hits? They can change their coverage from one carrier to another?
You're talking about after you retire, can you do the same thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, you have open seasons for the rest of your life. You have qualifying life events. If I'm retired and I've been retired for 2 years, living here in the D.C. area with my Kaiser, you know, some sort of HMO plan, and I move out to Colorado and that HMO is no longer available, even if it's not, I'm outside of an open season, that's a qualifying life event to change my health insurance plan in retirement. So I have QLEs and open seasons for the rest of my life. The open seasons tend to be in the same time frames, that mid-November to mid-December time frame for retirees as it is for employees. And it's effective January 1st of every year. So you're not stuck with the same plan forever.
So that would be true even if I was moved and I was a federal employee and I was moved. And like you say, I have Kaiser locally, but Kaiser didn't have coverage where I was moving. I could change my...
Absolutely. it's a qualifying life event to, you know, if you move out of the area where the coverage is available, that's a QLE to change your health insurance coverage to something
else. And I should say, we're not picking on Kaiser here.
They're
a friend of the show, and but you know, everybody can't be in every state in the country.
Yeah, Kaiser's the most popular HMO, so that's why I brought them up.
Slick. Very good. So then the health insurance, beyond the ability to change, people need to be aware, one, they can change, and two, why would they change? We were talking with an individual on the air last year, and the one spouse had retired early because they could retire early, and they still had children. And it was talking about the change that the health insurance now has to cover children up to 26. Mm-hmm. And I think there was only one plan prior to that that did that, but now they all do. And mm-hmm. so, again, this was somebody.
Yeah, starting on January 1st, you're going to be able to put them back on the books up until 26 years old.
So that's something people should be aware of. I think open season comes and goes, and we talk an awful lot. I'm not so sure how many people change, but there's some pretty serious issues this year of why maybe people should be looking at changing.
Sure. Medicare is another reason to think about later on in life when you become Medicare eligible. That's like a special open season that everybody has during that seven-month window surrounding their 65th birthday to change their federal employees' health benefits plan to become more compatible with Medicare. Because when you're 65 and older, become Medicare eligible, your FEHB, if you're retired, takes a back seat. You know, it's a secondary payer, and Medicare is the primary. So that's another thing, another type of life event later on in life that could cause you to think about changing your health insurance plan. You know, maybe you don't need that high option Blue Cross Blue Shield anymore. You know, you can switch to the low option when it's your secondary provider.
Great. And you can still have the health savings accounts in retirement that you do while on the job?
The health savings accounts you can still have, but you can't have the flexible spending accounts.
Right.
That's right. Okay. The health savings accounts you can have after you leave federal service. But and you can still contribute to it as long as you have a high deductible health insurance plan. That's what health savings accounts are associated with. These are high deductible health insurance plans.
So if you're pretty healthy or feel that you're going to maintain your health, this is not a bad. You're not really losing coverage. You're not really taking anything out of your pocket. In fact, you're trying to put money into
your pocket. Yeah, you go see the doctor once a year, you know, and you just got this high deductible health insurance coverage to save you money on premiums because the premiums tend to be cheaper.
Yeah.
And you still have a health savings account that you can use for the same type of things that you could have used while you were an employee with healthcare FSAs. And I guess, you know, we're not saying it, but it's basically understood that when you leave federal service, you cannot take advantage of your healthcare flexible spending accounts anymore.
Right. But that health savings account is like an IRA.
That's right.
If you're the proverbial healthy as a horse and you never take any money out of it, it's yours to spend later.
You can transfer it to something like a traditional IRA, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a fantastic deal. I'm not so sure that it's highly recognized as a great deal. I think the participation level is very small, but if we drill down, and we do, our first show in the open season, we call it the Alphabet Soup Show. So we try to say, okay, this is an FSA, this is an HSA, this is an HD, whatever, and so that everyone has hopefully a better understanding as the different guests come in after that.
Well, I don't know how much time we have, but related to healthcare FSAs, whether you're a brand new employee, mid-career, or preparing for retirement, I've got an example that I can share with you that I did when I left service, taking advantage of a healthcare flexible spending account. You know, these healthcare FSAs, you guys will talk about it in an upcoming class and allow you to set aside pre-tax dollars to pay for certain eligible expenses. And the open season before I was leaving service, I was getting my teeth cleaned. And for whatever reason, the dentist thought that my teeth needed to be straightened out. I thought my teeth were fine. I had no complaints before that. But evidently, she had a good friend that was an orthodontist down the street. She said, James, if you don't get these teeth straightened out now, it's going to cost you thousands of dollars later on in life. So I said, okay, what is this going to take? She said, braces. I said, how much are these braces that I want to get? She said, $4,000. Braces are an eligible expense under healthcare flexible spending accounts. So I set up a $4,000 healthcare flexible spending account during the open season, starting in pay period one. They took $4,000 divided by 26 pay periods. I started paying $250 into the healthcare flexible spending account. Immediately in January, I go get the x-rays, get the apparatus put on. I said, can I pay for it up front? She said, absolutely. I paid out of pocket $4,000. I got my receipt. I submitted it to healthcare FSA, and within a week, I got my direct deposit of $4,000 back. Because you can incur your expenses even before they're retailed for healthcare FSAs. So, you know, I'm happy. I got my braces on, got my money back in my pocket. Meanwhile, Healthcare FSA is getting their money back at the rate of $250 per pay period. But I didn't stick around for 26 pay periods. I left service at the end of March. And these are the same rules that apply to the federal government as they do in the private sector. So you can, anybody listening can apply this to any situation. If you're leaving your company soon, think about what do I want to do with my healthcare FSA, the open season, before I leave federal service, whether it's for retirement purposes or whether I'm 25 years old, it doesn't matter. You know, you're not responsible for paying back the remaining amount.
And it cuts both ways. That's why there's a balance, because people hear they go, ooh, but if somebody doesn't use their full amount,
they don't plan it properly.
And they lose it, it hopefully balances out.
Yeah, they have no problem keeping that money if someone doesn't use it properly. But it's the opposite of the use or lose feature, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, TSP. We got about 3 minutes. What do you want to say about TSP?
Well, the main thing is, I'm still surprised. Sometimes in the classes, a lot of employees don't realize that they got rid of those percentages, that CSRS and FERS folks were allowed to contribute a certain percentage of their pay every pay period. They got rid of that a couple of years ago, and now they allow federal employees, whether you're FERS or CSRS, to contribute what the IRS allows anybody in America to contribute to 401k type of plans. So it's a $16,500 limit, for example, for your regular TSP contribution. If you can afford to do so, you can reduce your taxable income by $16,500 by having that withheld, you know, throughout the year going into your thrift savings plan account. So they're no longer restricted to certain percentages of your pay. You know, and also the main thing, and this is especially for FERS employees, is taking advantage of the agency match, the 5% contribution. If you're contributing 5% of your pay in a pay period, the agency will also put in 5% of your pay into your thrift savings plan, dollar for dollar for the first 3% and 50 cents for every dollar for the fourth and fifth percent.
So that's like a 100% rate of return on your investment.
Yeah, you're giving away free money if you're not contributing at least 5% of your pay every single pay period.
Don't they mandatorily take out one? Just to protect yourself?
The new employees, they just changed this recently where the new employees are forcing them to put in, the 5%. I have to double check. They may be forcing them to put in 5%. Of course, as an employee, you can change it immediately. As soon as you come on board, you can say, no, I don't want to do that. But if, whether you're putting any money in or not, as a FERS employee, again, FERS employees get this, not CSRS, there's an automatic 1% contribution that the agency puts in to your thrift savings plan account for you, whether you put the money in or not.
I got an email from a gentleman last week and coming close to retirement and made the comment, I have no IRAs, I don't have a thrift, but I have a large brokerage account. And, you know, what do you say? So that was diplomatic. And I said, well, you've got a short period of time. You might want to consider the TSP. Instead of going into the brokerage account, go into the TSP. You can always put the money into the brokerage account after you leave federal service. Now, maybe the brokerage account is making so much money that it outstripped whatever the TSP could. It would be pretty rough to do, but it was just an interesting comment.
Sure.
But it was from an area where I don't think there was a lot of shows like this or retirement planning seminars and whatnot. Mm-hmm. All right, we got 1 minute. Final comments?
I just think it's important that folks think about taking a retirement class, whether it's at the beginning of their career, the middle of the career, or the end of their career. It's never too soon. It's never too late. I would highly recommend every 5 or 6 years taking a class because the laws or regulations could change. You want to keep up with what your benefits should be and how they're computed so that way, you know, you're going to make sure that you get the benefit that you deserve and that you earn during your federal career.
And I'm seeing more 20-somethings and early 30-somethings in the pre-retirement seminar only so that they make sure that they didn't miss what they should have known. Okay, well, it was great having you here, James. It's been a while, about a year or so.
It's been my pleasure.
I had my seatbelt on just trying to keep up with you. I think I did, but anyway, thanks for listening. Y'all will be on next week, and we'll talk about something very interesting. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on Federal News.